So we're in the middle of our fourth chapter, Reality Omnipresent. And we recall that the entire first book of The Life Divine, when it came out for publication, had as its overall title, Omnipresent Reality and the Universe. The largest sweep of existence, the universal, which comes out of a reality, and this universal being is not a denial of real existence. It is a deliberate manifestation of it. With this concept, we have come to the paragraph that begins, "And when we say that out of non-being, being appeared, we perceive that we are speaking in terms of time about that which is beyond time." We'll talk about that in a minute, but I want to back up just a second to that last quotation which Sri Aurobindo draws from the Upanishad to illustrate that the idea of non-being in the ancient Vedantic tradition suggests something other than an absolute non-existence. As he said in that paragraph above, non-being is only a word. When we look at what it means, we can't be sure that absolute non-existence has any better chance than the infinite self of being more than an ideative formation of the mind. If we're talking about a reality which is beyond the realm of anything that we can grasp with our senses, that our mind, which is a tool of division and measurement, cannot assay what is beyond it, when it is itself a limited kind of consciousness, what can it say about something which is beyond all figuration of consciousness? We can't encapsulate that reality in a phrase. The phrase would itself be left an empty shell a moment later because the reality has exceeded it. Even in the field of manifestation, which we can measure, that is true of our experience. So what meaningfully can we say about that which is beyond the essence of being, the silence behind silence, except that somehow it is unknowable? If this is the non-being, then we can understand in a way what it means. So let's now look at what this citation from the Upanishads says. The quotation at the bottom says, "Another Upanishad rejects the birth of being out of non-being as an impossibility." Remember the Taittiriya Upanishad, which Sri Aurobindo opened the chapter with as the motto, says that being comes out of non-being. Well, if that non-being means the unknowable, we can get a sense of what it means. But if you mean really that non-existence as an opposite of being precedes being, then how could being come out of it? And to this, an older Upanishad still than the Taittiriya offers the following, and this is 6.2. "In the beginning, son, this world was simply what is existent, one only, without a second." We've cited that before, you'll remember. Now, on this point, some do say, "In the beginning, this world was simply what is non-existent, one only without a second, and from what is non-existent was born what is existent." "But son, how can that possibly be?" he continued. "How can what is existent be born from what is non-existent?" "On the contrary, son, in the beginning, this world was simply what is existent, one only, without a second, and it thought to itself, 'Let me become many. Let me propagate myself.' It emitted heat The heat thought to itself, let me become many, let me propagate myself. It emitted water. Whenever it is hot, therefore, a man surely perspires, and thus it is from heat that water is produced. And on it goes in its own symbolic cosmology to explain how from sheer being comes all the various planes and formations of the worlds, that the universe is a manifestation of true being. This is the Chandogya. It is perhaps the second oldest of them all. Only the Brihadaranyaka might be older. So the first Upanishadic idea is, it is, not it isn't. So now we go back to our first paragraph tonight. And when we say that out of non-being, being appeared, we perceive that we are speaking in terms of time about that which is beyond time. Because any idea that we have about being or about what it opposite might be comes fashioned from our experience through the senses of the world. And these senses gather material which is moving in a field of space measured out in terms of time. So what is eternal to our constructed being is impossible to know. We can't know it in the way that we know that tomorrow follows today, or that on the other side of that door is the rest of the world. For what was that portentous date in the history of eternal nothing on which being was born out of it? Or when will come that other date, equally formidable, on which an unreal all will relapse into the perpetual void? Sat and Asat, if they have both to be affirmed, must be conceived as if they obtained simultaneously. Sat is existence. Asat means non-existence. So if you're going to conceive of them, they must coexist. Huh? They permit each other, Sri Aurobindo writes, even though they refuse to mingle. Both, since we must speak in terms of time, are eternal. And who shall persuade eternal being that it does not really exist, and only eternal non-being is? In such a negation of all experience, how shall we find the solution that explains all experience? Again, this is a lengthy commentary on Chandogya 6.2. And now we get to one of the axioms of affirmation, so characteristic of Sri Aurobindo's approach to being in the universe. Pure being is the affirmation by the unknowable of itself as the free base of all cosmic existence. So what is beyond this antinomy of sat and asat is an unknowable. But it posits itself deliberately as a sat, as pure being. And that becomes the free base of the universe which is extended out of, manifested from it. So if you want to draw lines which make no sense, at the top is the unknowable. And then that unknowable rolls itself out as pure being, which then intends to manifest the universe, and then all the way down to matter. That's pure being. He writes, we give the name of non-being to a contrary affirmation of its freedom from all cosmic existence. So, even though this unknowable posits itself as being which gives rise to the universe, it retains infinitely its freedom from that which it manifests. The unknowable is untouched from it, by it, and that is what we would call non-being. And you can compare the Gita on this, chapter 9, verses 4 and 5, if you want to go back and look them up. Chapter 8, 11 and 20. Chapter 13, verse 17. Chapter 15, verse 17. Have a look sometime. So, freedom, that is to say, from all positive terms of actual existence which consciousness in the universe can formulate to itself, even from the most abstract, even from the most transcendent, so, thus, even from Sat. It is free even from its extension as pure being. This unknowable is all-swallowing. This would remind us of the Mandukya Upanishad, which describes that fourth state of being, the Turiya, which is beyond even the deep silence of pure Atman awareness, beyond the creative consciousness of the Godhead, beyond clearly the visible extent of the manifested universe. That Turiya is something which exceeds all and yet somehow incorporates all within it. This is the Godhead without a name. This is that which cannot be defined, which cannot be known. Sri Aurobindo continues, it does not deny them as a real expression of itself, but it denies its limitation by all expression or any expression whatsoever. This too goes back to the Vedantic formulae we find in the Gita, where the divine stands at the core of all beings and yet exceeds them. Both is and is not, this being, that being, is the Akshara Brahman, is the Kshara Brahman, but or Purusha, but is not at the same time, is all exceeding, even when it enters deeply into everything, when nothing can draw its breath and everything is derived from its immensity, from its intangible essence. Yet, it is not that. The non-being permits the being, even as the silence permits the activity. By this simultaneous negation and affirmation, not mutually destructive, but complementary to each other like all contraries, the simultaneous awareness of conscious self-being as a reality and the unknowable beyond as the same reality becomes realizable to the awakened human soul. Thus, was it possible for the Buddha to attain the state of nirvana and yet act puissantly in the world, impersonal in his inner consciousness, in his action, the most powerful personality that we know of as having lived and produced results upon earth. What he has just written here about the Buddha is true of Sri Aurobindo's own inner state, because this is something that he got with his first major realization in 1908, sitting with Lele on the rooftop in Baroda. It is his humility, obviously, would be inappropriate for him to mention personal biographical information like that. But those who were close to Sri Aurobindo knew this, and those who heard him speak in Bengal when he gave his Uttar Pradesh speech knew how vast was his realization that it was not simply of this nirvanic non-being behind and beyond the universe, but also that which incorporated all else. This is a statement about Buddha which reflects a Mahayanist understanding of the Buddha's life and teaching. We may have occasion to talk about that another time, but this discussion of non-being and nirvana reminded me of something that comes much later in The Life Divine, in a chapter called The Origin of the Ignorance, and I think we'll take a moment, if you don't mind, to look at what he says later, because it reflects very much upon this passage and in fact builds upon it. And of course we'll meet it many months later, many, many months later. The unknowable, if it is at all, may be a supreme state of Satchit Ananda beyond our highest conceptions of existence, consciousness, and bliss. That is what was evidently meant by the Asat, the non-existent of the Taittiriya Upanishad, which alone was in the beginning and out of which the existent was born, and possibly too, it may be the inmost sense of the Nirvana of the Buddha. For the dissolution of our present state by Nirvana may be a reaching to some highest state beyond all notion or experience of self, even an ineffable release from our sense of existence. Or it may be the Upanishad's absolute and unconditioned bliss, which is beyond expression and beyond understanding, because it surpasses all that we can conceive of or describe as consciousness and existence. This is the sense in which we have already accepted it, for the acceptation commits us only to a refusal to put a limit to the ascension of the infinite. Or if it is not this, if it is something quite different from existence, even from an unconditioned existence, it must be the absolute non-being of the nihilistic thinker. So what this is a reality beyond the extent of our experiential, phenomenal life. It is something beyond the measurement of time, beyond the conditions of space. And we can seat ourselves in that calm, in that absolute silence, and yet continue to work and act in the world, as he says, to act puissantly in the world. That means powerfully. In your inner being, impersonal, behind the play of the ego and its many conditions changing, and the action unrolling from that silence produces powerful results. Remember last week when we cited what Sri Aurobindo wrote in Savitri, from an absolute silence comes an absolute power. When we ponder on these things, he continues writing, we begin to perceive how feeble in their self-assertive violence and how confusing in their misleading distinctness are the words that we use. We begin also to perceive that the limitations we impose on the Brahman arise from a narrowness of experience in the individual mind, which concentrates itself on one aspect of the unknowable and proceeds forthwith to deny or disparage all the rest. Remember, that's the antinomy that we began with. That's the problem. The materialist affirms matter, denies the spiritualist experiences the spirit beyond time and denies the conditions of the world and matter. Remember, too, what we were speaking about with reference to Sri Aurobindo's epistemology. That beyond the niceties of ratiocinative thought and the firm realities that philosophy thinks it can assign to categories of existence, Sri Aurobindo asserts, in consonance with the Upanishads, that it is the experience of reality which is the final arbiter. You know it because you experience. And here he's saying the same thing. It is the narrownesses of experience that leads us to disparage all the rest. We have a perspective, but it's not a complete view. A partial perspective, 1 degree of the 360, does not tell us everything. We tend always to translate too rigidly what we can conceive or know of the absolute into terms of our own particular relativity. We affirm the one and identical by passionately discriminating and asserting the egoism of our own opinions and partial experiences against the opinions and partial experiences of others. So this is perspectivity, but it's one brand of ignorance in combat with another brand of ignorance, because both are limited. And so neither can be final. Likely they are complementary. Likely they are consumed in a larger reality. It is wiser, he writes, to wait, to learn, to grow, and since we are obliged for the sake of our self-perfection, to speak of these things which no human speech can express, to search for the widest, the most flexible, the most catholic affirmation possible, and found on it the largest and most comprehensive harmony. So the implied goal of the soul of the in the universe is set in this sentence, to reach for this catholic affirmation, to unite again both poles of being. And again, it's down to harmony. Remember, in the first page of the Life Divine, depending on which edition you look at, I guess, all problems are problems of harmony. If we are stuck in our immediate experience, we think the world is painful, the world is limited, the world is ignorant, bungling, going round and round in circles. It's madness. If we can step out of that ego box and become one with the all, with the universe, we see that there is a general harmony and there is an advance towards a goal which the cosmos implies. It doesn't state it in words, but it's going somewhere, and you can feel it in the very sinews of the universe if you become like the universe, if you become one with it. And then where does this universe get that push? What is it that drives it? Except this unknowable, this undefinable absolute that is behind. Is it being? Is it non-being? Questions which the mind can never fully or finally answer, but which the soul, as it experiences more and more largely, can stand under and therefore understand by becoming that base. And again, what is it that leads us to that except the widening experience? Again, experience will be the way that we measure what is real and what is concrete and what is subtle. This will be key to the rest of our study of the Life Divine. We recognize then that it is possible for the consciousness in the individual to enter into a state in which relative existence appears to be dissolved, and even self seems to be an inadequate conception. It is possible to pass into a silence beyond the silence. But this is not the whole of our ultimate experience, nor the single and all-excluding truth. For we find that this nirvana, this self-extinction, while it gives an absolute peace and freedom to the soul within, is yet consistent in practice with a desireless but effective action without. Sri Aurobindo, 1908. Is opened somehow to this engulfing Brahmic nirvana, and yet within days is back at the lectern, back on the podium, speaking to his enchained brethren and sisters about how they might throw off the yoke of British tyranny. All when there is no Aravinda anymore. There is only this mighty impersonality acting and speaking. And a few reminiscences from people said that they could go back and remember that speech, and then understanding Sri Aurobindo's biography as it was published later, understand that he had undergone this tremendous change, and that must be why his words had such resonance, had such finality, had such force, that they felt that even though they were indentured to the British, they could rise up and stand against them and say, give us our country back. So let's continue in this paragraph. This possibility of an entire motionless impersonality and void calm within, doing outwardly the works of the eternal verities, love, truth, and righteousness, was perhaps the real gist of the Buddha's teaching. This superiority to ego and to the chain of personal workings and to the identification with mutable form and idea, not the petty ideal of an escape from the trouble and suffering of the physical birth. It's clear that Sri Aurobindo wants to bring into this as much as he can, the teaching of the Buddha, and he's spoken wonderfully here about him. But to be frank, this again is a Mahayanist interpretation of the Buddha. And the earliest that we know about the Buddha speaking in Pali, probably taking from the Magadhi, is that if we can say anything about the Buddha, it is certainly true that he said that the world is a field of trouble and suffering, dukkha. So while Sri Aurobindo tries to free him from that, that was something that the Buddha said over and over again in every sermon and every personal interview that he gave. So I think it's better to accept that and to see later what the experience of the Buddha was, as we spoke earlier, a few months ago, about the nature of Buddha and his teaching. We'll probably have occasion to come back to it again in our review of The Life Divine. In any case, as the perfect man would combine in himself the silence and the activity, so also would the completely conscious soul reach back to the absolute freedom of the non-being without therefore losing its hold on existence and the universe. So, again, through identity with that, you share in that absolute freedom, even while you work through the nama and the rupa, the name and the form given to you in the here and now, marching in this universe. It would thus reproduce in itself perpetually, the eternal miracle of the divine existence in the universe, yet always beyond it, and even, as it were, beyond itself. That encapsulates it perfectly. And this, of course, is what we see in the Gita in its expression often, that I am this, all this is in me, and yet I am beyond it. Behold, this is the mystery of my existence, says the Purushottama to Arjuna. The human emulates the divine. We have always the capacity to express through ourselves all the states which the divine freely holds. We can grow into that, and that is entirely the process of yoga. The process of yoga through all the powers of our being, consciousness, feeling, dynamism. The opposite experience, Sri Aurobindo writes, could only be a concentration of mentality in the individual upon non-existence, with the result of an oblivion and personal withdrawal from a cosmic activity still and always proceeding in the consciousness of the eternal being. So, yes, you can, in a sense, take yourself out of it. You can, in a sense, cancel all activity in the phenomenal world and retire into that absolute stasis of the divine. Into that silence. But the divine continues to work and manifest the world and manifest itself in souls which are becoming more and more free, more and more conscious. So, there's the contradiction. We might terminate in the divine, but the divine in the universe continues. Thus, after reconciling spirit and matter in the cosmic consciousness, we perceive the reconciliation in the transcendental consciousness of the final assertion of all and its negation. We discover that all affirmations are assertions of status or activity in the unknowable. All the corresponding negations are assertions of its freedom, both from and in that status or activity. The unknowable is something to us supreme, wonderful, and ineffable, which continually formulates itself to our consciousness and continually escapes from the formulation it has made. This it does not as some malicious spirit or freakish magician leading us from falsehood to greater falsehood and so to a final negation of all things, but as even here, the wise beyond our wisdom, guiding us from reality to ever profounder and vaster reality, until we find the profoundest and vastest of which we are capable. An omnipresent reality is the Brahman, not an omnipresent cause of persistent illusions. You can put a mark next to that. The title of the chapter, the title of the first book. Here's the big picture. We take it as a given. This is a postulate. This is an axiomatic. An omnipresent reality is the Brahman. It is not here to create illusions, it is creating realities, all derived from its oneness, its unspeakable oneness. If we thus accept a positive basis for our harmony, and on what other can harmony be founded? The various conceptual formulations of the unknowable, each of them representing a truth beyond conception, must be understood as far as possible in their relation to each other and in their effect upon life, not separately, not exclusively, not so affirmed as to destroy or unduly diminish all other affirmations. The real monism, the true Advaita, is that which admits all things as the one Brahman and does not seek to bisect its existence into two incompatible entities, an eternal truth and an eternal falsehood, Brahman and not Brahman, self and not self, a real self and an unreal, yet perpetual Maya. If it be true that the self alone exists, it must be also true that all is the self. And in this he gives the lie to Shankara. And if this self, God or Brahman, is no helpless state, no bounded power, no limited personality, but the self-conscient all, there must be some good and inherent reason in it for the manifestation, to discover which we must proceed on the hypothesis of some potency, some wisdom, some truth of being in all that is manifested. Again, another star, put a mark there. The discord and apparent evil of the world must be in their sphere, must in their sphere be admitted, but not accepted as our conquerors. The deepest instinct of humanity seeks always, and seeks wisely, wisdom as the last word of the universal manifestation, not an eternal mockery and illusion, a secret and finally triumphant good, not an all-creative and invincible evil, an ultimate victory and fulfillment, not the disappointed recoil of the soul from its great adventure. This universe is not a field of suffering. This is not dukkha. No. This is Sat Chit Ananda, the real conscious existence manifested for the purpose of delight. And our soul will only feel fulfilled when we have found that to be the bottom of the mystery. Also, he is asserting here that there is a cosmic purpose and a destination, that there is a teleological aspect to the universe which we can perceive as our consciousness grows into alignment with it. If we just look at it blankly from the view of the senses, we see that the universe is senseless. But as we become one with the universe, we begin to sense its movement forward, that it has a kind of developing urge leading to some wonderful conclusion. And in this, we'll find that Sri Aurobindo posits evolution as a mainspring of the cosmic impulse. So, for we cannot suppose that the soul entity is compelled by something outside or other than itself, since no such thing exists. There is only one. The many come from the one. Nor can we suppose that it submits unwillingly to something partial within itself, which is hostile to its whole being, denied by it, and yet too strong for it. For this would be only to erect in other language the same contradiction of an all and something other than the all. This is no Manichaean universe, then. Even if we say that the universe exists merely because the self in its absolute impartiality tolerates all things alike, viewing with indifference all actualities and all possibilities, yet is there something that wills the manifestation and supports it, and this cannot be something other than the all. So will is an element of conscious existence. Brahman is indivisible in all things. Huh? Axiomatic. And whatever is willed in the world has been ultimately willed by the Brahman. It is only our relative consciousness, alarmed or baffled by the phenomena of evil, ignorance, and pain in the cosmos, that seeks to deliver the Brahman from responsibility for itself and its workings by erecting some opposite principle, Maya or Mara, conscious devil or self-existent principle of evil. There is one Lord and self, and the many are only his representations and becomings. Bhagavad Gita, chapter 9, verse 4. Bhagavad Gita, chapter 13, verse 17. And this, again, denies the message of Buddhism. So, if then the world is a dream or an illusion or a mistake, it is a dream originated and willed by the self in its totality, and not only originated and willed, but supported and perpetually entertained. And Sri Aurobindo is being a little entertaining here, as he has exhibited his humor in several passages. He does it again. Moreover, it is a dream existing in a reality, and the stuff of which it is made is that reality, for Brahman must be the material of the world as well as its base and continent. If there is only one, hailing from that unknowable, and that one expresses itself as the many, it is substantiating that oneness in the multiplicity and in its play. It cannot be otherwise. So though Sri Aurobindo is being amusing, there is a solid point to his argument. If the gold of which the vessel is made is real, how shall we suppose that the vessel itself is a mirage? So you take gold and you make a ring out of it. It is always resolvable back into the gold from which it came. The form is an expression of the gold. But the gold is there. If the gold weren't there, the form could not come into existence. And so it is with all of this. We see that these words, dream, illusion, are tricks of speech, habits of our relative consciousness. They represent a certain truth, even a great truth, but they also misrepresent it. Just as non-being turns out to be other than mere nullity, so the cosmic dream turns out to be other than mere phantasm and hallucination of the mind. Phenomenon is not phantasm. Phenomenon is the substantial form of a truth, just as the ring is a real form of the gold. Non-being, if it is an unknowable beyond the perception or the measurements of senses or mind. We cannot know it as an object, but we can perceive its formal appearance. We can perceive it. We can become one with it in our spiritual consciousness, which can then suffuse our natural instruments and transform them. Ah, but I digress. So, on to the final paragraph. We start then with the conception of an omnipresent reality of which neither the non-being at the one end nor the universe at the other are negations that annul. They are, rather, different states of the reality, obverse and reverse affirmations. The highest experience of this reality in the universe shows it to be not only a conscious existence, but a supreme intelligence and force and a self-existent bliss. And beyond the universe, it is still some other unknowable existence, some utter and ineffable bliss. So this is Sat-Chit-Ananda, and the distinction here in Vedantic terms is between the Saguna Brahman and the Nirguna Brahman. that Brahman which takes form, which is definable and experienceable as Sat, existence, Chit, conscious power, and Ananda, bliss, delight, and that Nirguna, which is that unknowable, which cannot be captured even by these terms, because those are terms extended from our experience of the world. That is still too large a picture for the widest mind to embrace, to draw into its ken. Therefore, we are justified in supposing that even the dualities of the universe, when interpreted not as now by our sensational and partial conceptions, but by our liberated intelligence and experience, will be also resolved into those highest terms. While we still labor under the stress of the dualities, this perception must no doubt constantly support itself on an act of faith, but a faith which the highest reason, the widest and most patient reflection do not deny, but rather affirm. This creed is given, indeed, to humanity to support it on its journey until it arrives at a stage of development when faith will be turned into knowledge and perfect experience and wisdom will be justified of her works. So again, we come to the reality that experienceable. It is that experience which gives us the knowledge which justifies the faith. Faith, Sri Aurobindo will say a decade later, as he begins to write letters to his disciples, is not belief. Faith is something that is stirred from the level of the soul and is the soul's way of feeling. It is a soul knowledge, S-O-U-L. And faith shapes us. As is a person's faith, so is that person destined to be. So if our deepest experience of faith finally allows the soul to step forward into the outer chambers of our lives, then knowledge moves us. And that identity that we find with the divine justifies the works which we undertake as a growing expression of divinity exploring itself in the universe. And that is real. We find that reality everywhere. It is indeed omnipresent. Omnipresent and ever-present. So, I think with that we conclude this fourth chapter. We'll be taking up the fifth, the destiny of the individual, next Sunday. So, any questions or comments this evening? Much to meditate on, eh? Anything from our friends in Zoom land? Good. Then we'll go and sit for our meditation then. Jai Ma. Namaste.